This is The Conversation, episode 125 with artist Colleen Asper, Brooklyn-based artist, activist, and teacher of up to now 14 schools. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this show is theconversationpod.com. Our last episode, number 124, was with New York-based performance-slash-food artist Allison Kuo. Kuoskies, I believe, is her Twitter and Instagram handle, which I love, Kuoskies. Great conversation about not only her food performances and working with food and her former photo blog, Accidental Chinese Hipsters, but also what it's like living in Manhattan and being a Dallas expat and a Texas expat in that community in New York. Good stuff. Colleen and I talk about many things aside from art or sort of tangentially related to art, including her activist work with Occupy, her challenge with her former rental in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, and the things she learned through talking to lawyers and dealing with her crazy new landlord and so on. A lot to be learned there. And the reason I think it relates to art is because it's about housing and gentrification, and that all, of course, connects back to the ever-expanding gentrification of New York artists and L.A. artists and eventually neighborhoods throughout the country. Obviously, San Francisco is like the king of artists being pushed out. You know, there really are so few artists left there. Anyway, I think it's all related. I hope you enjoy the conversation, and let's get to it with Colleen right now. I will talk to you on the back end. Stay tuned for that side. Just one quick producer note. The school that we are talking about at the beginning is Yale. To what extent is your teaching there connected to your being a student there?
I mean, it's probably, you know, very much connected insofar as Rochelle Feinstein, who she actually just stepped down as the head of the painting program, but she, when she was the head of the painting program, she brought me in. But I also, I mean, I've taught it. Well, starting Tuesday when I go to PAFA, I will have taught at 14 schools.
Wow.
So I had, you know, I definitely had to like go out there and teach it at a bunch of other places before I got asked back.
Right. You know, something that I was thinking about, because of the Yale thing and the fact that you've been an engaged teacher at various art schools and institutions, is how invaluable is it being having a Yale degree, whether it's a BA or an MFA, when you are applying to become a teacher anywhere?
I think it's hard to totally quantify that because, I mean, I don't think that any of the places that I've taught hired me on the basis that I have an MFA from Yale.
Right, right.
You know, that's so ubiquitous,
right.
Almost. But, you know, especially early on, like many of the teaching gigs that I got were through people that I met there.
Got it. Yeah, so it's the connectivity element.
Right, yeah.
Right, got it. So you're in Bed-Stuy right now. Is that correct? Did I remember that right?
I'm actually in Clinton Hill.
Okay,
now.
Sorry about that.
I moved about a year and a half ago.
Right. Okay. That'll route us back to our where we wanted to go. So Ted, who you were introduced to me by, is in Bed-Stuy, and you are in nearby Clinton Hill. And does it matter if we mention that you guys were a couple at one point?
Yeah, I mean, that's fine. At this point, it was over a decade ago that we dated, so it's very, you know, ancient.
Right.
We've been friends for a lot longer than we dated.
Right.
So I don't tend to think of him at all as like an ex. I think of him as a friend, but it's fine it's not like a secret or something.
Yeah, no. But getting back to my error in locating you, because we had this conversation that you were in Bed-Stuy and you are now in Clinton Hill, and that is partly or largely or completely due to the fact that you had a run-in in your former home, correct?
Right. Yeah, I mean, my trajectory in New York has been, I lived in Clinton Hill for about 6 years. I didn't get forced out of my apartment, but it, you know, became increasingly expensive. And then I moved to Bed-Stuy, into a place that was really super under market value, really amazing, 1,000 square feet. I think it was 1,250 when I moved in, or maybe it was just 1,200. And I was there for 4 years when my building got sold. And the purchaser was an LLC called No Tomorrow.
Right.
And they forced everyone out of the building. And I was able to hold on for an extra year because I had this obscure clause in my lease that allowed me to renew at my discretion for 3 years after the first year of my lease.
Mm-hmm.
Which is maybe a kind of useful thing to throw out there, because when Alexander, my partner, and I moved into the apartment that we're currently at, we actually asked the landlord if they would put this on a lease, and they agreed to it. So it's a kind of nice thing to have, to be able to renew at your discretion.
Right.
So yeah, I became, you know, the tenant that was living in this, and then the woman beneath me, because they wanted us out at the same time so they could renovate through, you know, going underneath to rearrange the plumbing. We were living in a building that was like completely otherwise abandoned, and they would do things like tear out the steps, and you know, we're just doing like massive overhaul. You know, I would come home one day and like my entire apartment would be like covered in brick dust because they had decided to you know, tear down walls outside of the apartment. But
Were you feeling like during that time that I need to get out of here, or was it more like furthering your resolve that you were going to fight?
Well, I mean, during the course of that year, I think I saw 6 lawyers.
Wow.
Because at first I was, you know, well, part of this that I should mention is that as they began moving into the apartments that they renovated, they through spying and chatting with the neighbors, I was able to figure out that they were turning, you know, these open loft spaces into 5-bedroom apartments, and they were renting them out by the month, which is illegal in New York.
Right.
Makes it a boarding house. So at first I thought, aha, you know, this is fantastic. What they're doing is illegal. I'm going to bust them. And I actually got Ted to go and pretend to be someone who was interested in the apartment and get a copy of the lease. So I had proof of that. But in the end, I fell into this kind of loophole where, you know, every lawyer I saw was like, yes, what they're doing is indeed illegal, but they're going to do that after they evict you, and therefore evicting you is not illegal.
Mm. How did you manage to see that many lawyers?
You know, none of these were lawyers that I was paying for. It was all like, oh, you know, my friend's friend is a lawyer.
Right.
She'll talk to you on the phone.
Right.
Or, you know, I went to like a night that, you know, happens like once a month in New York where you can go and get free legal counseling on housing issues. So yeah, it was just like me, going to lawyers through like circuitous routes via
right.
friends and
right.
and then like very limited services.
Right. And so how did things play out ultimately?
Well, I mean, in the end, I moved out at the end of that year, because the other thing that I should mention that I, you know, even though I thought I knew a lot about how real estate works in New York, something that I didn't realize until I found myself in this predicament is if you appear in housing court in New York, but not just in New York, other states do this as well, the courts will sell a list of everybody who appears in housing court to these corporations that in turn will create these blacklists that landlords then, if they want to screen tenants, can have access to.
Mm-hmm.
So if you, you know, you could appear in housing court because your, you know, your heat wasn't on for 3 months, or, you know, it doesn't at all discern between people who are appearing in housing court, you know, for whatever reason. And then it can make it very difficult for you to rent an apartment in New York ever more. So in the end, it seemed like I didn't have a strong case, and it wasn't worth, you know, appearing on one of these blacklists.
Right. Is there, and then since you did mention that you had this information on them, to what extent did you feel like pursuing it after you had moved, or were you kind of like, I need to break from this?
I fully intended to pursue it after I moved, and then I swiftly became like completely exhausted with the whole situation, and have really done little else other than complain about it.
Right, and and maybe that is their understanding, that is their approach in sort of pressuring tenants out, is that they know that they're not going to have the resolve or the resources to put up much of a fight.
Yeah, I mean, it's also a situation that, you know, even if they had been busted for this, which is difficult to do, because if you call 311 and you complain, you know, you say this illegal thing is happening in this building I know about, they'll send someone to investigate. And if nobody answers the door, then, you know, I think they do that a certain amount of times, and then that's, you know, that's sort of the end of the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
But even if they had been busted for this, I mean, I think it would in the end amount to a small fine for them, which comparative to the, you know, the money they're making with this ridiculous scheme would not make it, you know, unworth their while then to continue.
Mm-hmm. What kind of rental situation do they have going now, as far as you know?
So I'm in my old apartment. They're doing this in apartments all throughout Brooklyn. It's 5 bedrooms that are rented out by the month.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I mean, people move in there not knowing who, you know, who they're going to be living with. But one of the great ironies of talking with, trying to remember what his name was, I think it was Dan, the guy who was, you know, head of the Snow Tomorrow LLC.
Right.
As he said at some point, he was like, I don't think of my, this is actually my downstairs neighbor when she met with him to try and negotiate something. He said to her, you know, I don't think of myself as a landlord so much as I think of myself as a curator. Right. Which is just like the great horror of like the curator or the artist or like the precarious labor becoming the, you know, the figurehead for like every gross capitalist. But yeah, so he was like, I think of myself as a curator of communities.
Yeah. That word actually, which has been mentioned on this podcast before and in a non-art contextual way, you know, the way it's been usurped as a word, that sounds like the worst usurping of that word possible out there at this point.
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
Yeah.
I mean, while the whole thing was happening, I really felt like I was making it up. Like I would tell people like, I would tell them the story, and then I would be like, and the LLC is called No Tomorrow. And they would be like, you're making that up. But
so yeah, as opposed to an Airbnb situation, they advertise online on who knows, you know, your typical apartment finder type website, and people sign up for these one bedrooms or these bedrooms, I should say, go and check them out, understand that they're going to be living with random people like random roommates. And because the price meets their, you know, their level and they have no other alternatives, that's what they go in for. And that's how they get their tenants.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, it's super sad because by the bedroom, you know, what you're paying in rent might seem cheaper than other places that you're looking at. But if all of those, you know, the cumulative rent that the entire apartment is paying is well over market value.
Right, right.
So if these random, you know, 4 or 5 people could have just met and rented a 4 or 5 bedroom apartment together, they would be paying much less.
Right.
Yeah. It's like the surcharge is for like not having friends or something.
Well, I was going to say that they're capitalizing on the new to New York people, essentially.
Right.
Which is sort of a never ending stream, isn't it?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I there were Pratt students moving into my building as I was being forced out while I was teaching at Pratt.
Did you have enough conversations to find some people who are moving into your building who you knew or knew?
Oh, no, just people that I, you know, because some of the apartments were renovated while I was still there. The people that were moving in,
right.
I just, you know, through like casual hallway chat or whatever, found out that there were some Pratt students among them.
Right.
And I was like, great.
Yeah.
And I teach there and I'm being forced out.
Wow. When did your involvement in Occupy begin?
It actually began pre-Occupy. I mean, I guess there were two kind of simultaneous routes, that I got involved in that through. One was I was part of a reading group, that was through the public school called the Anti-State Communist Reading Group. And that reading group had been meeting for about a year prior to Occupy. I joined maybe 3 months or so before it disbanded. But at any rate, that group of people who had been meeting and reading together for some time disbanded as a reading group with the idea of working on other sorts of projects with one another. And that was right about the time that organizing for Occupy started happening. So. I was working primarily with those folks. And then I also, I was actually knowing we were going to have this conversation. I was trying to remember how it even kind of all got started. But there was a meeting at 16 Beaver, which is a space in New York that hosts political conversations and gatherings of various sorts. And there was a meeting there that David Graeber, who's like gone on to become, you know, one of the people that that is heavily kind of associated with Occupy, he's written about it. He happened to be there, and he was a former teacher of mine and is now a friend. And it just came out casually in conversation that Adbusters had put out this call to Occupy Wall Street on September 17th. And David was, maybe still is, I think, on the editorial board of Adbusters. And so he called them and was just like, what is, you know, what's the deal? Like, are you organizing something? And they said, no, you know, we just put out this call and just thought, we'll see what happened, what would happen. And that night, David and I, and I think maybe 3 or 4 other people ended up getting a drink and just saying like, hey, what would happen if we tried to actually organize something for this? So that, there was that. There was this meeting at 16 Beaver and that kind of conversation after, and we decided to organize the first General Assembly the following Saturday, I believe. So this would have been like July before Occupy. And we ended up having these General Assemblies weekly leading up to September 17th to plan for it. So yeah, my involvement was... I guess from the very beginning.
Right. And how did your involvement play out then from there?
You know, I had this funny feeling during Occupy that I haven't ever quite shaken, which is when I talk about it with people who are a part of it or people that I was working with, we like almost exclusively talk about it critically. You know, like, oh, this went wrong, and, and we're so angry about how this happened, and then, you know, these people that we had this working relationship, we feel really terrible about now, et cetera. But then when I talked to people about it who, and I felt this way really strongly while it was happening, when I talked to people about it who weren't involved, I tend to feel, like, more defensive.
Right.
So, I guess that's all, which is a way of saying I have very complicated feelings about it.
Yeah. Well, my sense at this, you know, distant from the core point of it is that you know, based on my limited experience with it, I guess I went to a rally in downtown LA that was one, and you know, this was quite a bit into it, so it was very self-conscious to the extent there was media there, including cameras. So I felt very self-conscious, and I always do at rallies, the couple or few that I've been to. But all that to say that I think from the limited sense that I have of what the inside was like, there was a lot of disagreement about how to move forward, and a lot of difficulty wrangling for agreement and or power within. And yet, that said, my sense is from listening to people who have followed it closely and whatnot, is that the, you know, and certainly in the news alone, is that the effects have been significant in the country, if not the world.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the case. I mean, a lot of, you know, like the obvious, maybe it would be like the 1%, or, you know, some of these catchphrases or slogans that kind of came out of Occupy have become, at this point, you know, have like completely entered the mainstream political discourse.
And in addition to that, Occupy itself gave out a significant amount of money to people or organizations. Maybe you can help me with these kinds of details. You know, not just the cultural language, but also very specific assistance came out of it.
Do you have any specific examples?
I didn't do my homework
I'm like,
on
I'm
this.
I'm not entirely sure what you're...
Yeah, no, I don't... I can't think of anything specifically, but I do remember hearing about them giving to maybe an organization that needed help with its rent or ownership or a few individuals. I can't remember, but it was something along those lines.
I mean, there are certainly things that came out of Occupy, like Occupy Debt, you know, which is something I was not involved in. I'm not involved in, so I can't, you know, speak in any great detail to that. But yeah, I mean, Occupy Debt certainly was giving, you know, money to debt relief. Mm-hmm. But yeah, yeah. I mean, my own experience was, you know, I was very intensive, like a lot of really, you know, intensive planning and working closely with a group of people prior to the actual occupation to get it organized and shaped. And then once it was underway, you know, the people that I had been organizing with largely identified as anarchists and, you know, were definitely on the really far left of that space. So we spent a lot of time like being like really cranky about how, you know, these, whatever, just the more kind of like liberal, sort of positions were kind of playing out within that space. So, you know, I talked to, you know, especially a lot of artists I know who, were a part of Occupy, were a part of it later and were parts of things like the Arts and Labor Committee or Occupy Museums. But my,
what was the, sorry, what was the last, Occupy group that
Occupy
you mentioned?
Occupy Museums.
How do you spell that?
Oh, just museums, like Occupy Museums.
Oh, okay. Got it.
So, but yeah, my experience was, you know, like not showing up in that space as an artist or interested in kind of showing up in that space as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like, you know, not being a part of these like more, like solidified kind of working groups, but instead being this more like cranky, being a part of like a more like cranky kind of, you know, like almost fringe element or something,
right,
within that space,
right.
Who was forever kind of like, you know, we were like trying to figure out ways to like further radicalize the space, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that
but being like cantankerous within it?
Isn't that cantankerous element what's hard about sustaining, you know, a sort of hardcore organization, you know, in the face of you know, the march of capitalism, I guess, not to sound too extreme, but maybe as you are sort of implying for yourself, your life in, you know, the life of your involvement could only be so finite. And, you know, then you had to sort of move on. And that was the case probably with the, you know, your collaborators and your artist friends, perhaps.
Yeah. I mean, I want to be careful because I don't, and how I address that, because I don't know. And maybe this is just me like wishing it weren't so, you know, I mean, it's a very common thing to get burnt out when you're, working really intensively in those kind of spaces. And
right.
I think,
What is the most, let's pinpoint it. What is the most draining or exhausting element that makes you get burnt out doing that?
Well, I think there are two things. Like, one, you know, when you're involved, I mean, especially in something like an occupation, but even in like an evening of protest, there's like endless, you know, downtime. There's like endless time where you're just sort of wandering around or it's unclear what's going to happen next, or,
right.
you know, maybe you'll go here, maybe you'll do that. So, you know, there's a lot of this, you know, this sort of, like the space of protest is like full of a lot of like meandering uncertainty.
Right.
And, you know, it's not all this like, you know, sort of like active outcry. There's like a lot of meandering. And then of course there's, the relationships between people, which can be really intense. I mean, one of the things that I experienced that, you know, I know a lot of people experienced in that space was the, you know, like my growing disappointment and eventual like real outrage over how, the group of people that I was working with most closely, realizing like the women, essentially women in the group, came together and began to speak about how we felt like we were continually being silenced in meetings, and, you know, even issues of sexual harassment or sexual assault. And so we called some feminist meetings within this sort of smaller group of people we were working within Occupy. And those ended up being really, extremely contentious. You know, we had people who called us gender nationalists, and you know, said things like, "I'm a professional activist. Like, it's not, you know, this is like personal stuff that you're wanting to talk about." And that was really shocking to me, that people who were so identified as, you know, part of a radical left could be so like 1950s. In terms of the gender politics.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, I mean, I think that's, you know, and obviously for different people, how the kind of conflicts or contradictions that appeared between the people that they were working with kind of played out was really different for different folks. But,
how did these aggro or chauvinist figures respond to, you know, I assume your questions or your other female colleagues' questions of, you know, you are working on this anarchistic far left campaign and you are being a sexist? How do you reconcile those things? How do they respond to questions like that?
Really poorly. I mean, that's when things were said like, "Oh, you're being a gender nationalist. There's not a problem here. You know, this is all in your head, or this is not to talk about this like in a political space isn't appropriate because you're talking about like personal problems that you have with people." I mean, it was really like shocking how poorly that conversation played out.
I think you just described one of the reasons, if not others, why Occupy was not more effective.
Right. I mean, I can say that speaking personally, yes, like absolutely in terms of the people I was working with, that is what prevented me from continuing to work with them. And again, I know that to have played out on a larger scale in different ways for other people. Mm-hmm. But then I also would want to say that it's not as if, you know, Occupy created a space that was like more sexist than, or more racist or, you know, whatever than like the dominant culture.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that, because just as you were saying that, one of the things that I've been thinking about the last few minutes is, okay, how are certain listeners who are saying to their speakers, what does this have to do with art? You know, how are we going to respond to that? And I think you just implicated one answer, which is, okay, well, how are these dynamics playing out in the art faculties, you know, among other places? I don't know what other venues come to mind first for you.
Yeah. I mean, it's even worse. It's much worse than academia.
Okay, there you go. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. And obviously in the gallery sphere or kind of any kind of sphere that you could turn to in the art world, I think. Yeah. I mean, I can, a place that I taught at recently, I'm trying to decide whether or not it,
it could be mentioned.
I think it's fine for me to name them. So I had a full-time 2-year position at Mass Art, that ended in the spring. And,
I'm sorry, just for people, including myself, did you say Mass as in M-A-S-S?
Yeah, so Massachusetts College of Art and Design.
Oh, okay, got it.
In Boston.
Okay, thank
you. So I was commuting between New York and Boston, which was really nuts. But yeah, this visiting artist position that I had, it's a full-time position, but it's a 2-year position. And I think historically it's been kind of used at Mass Art to like bring in women and people of color. But on the one hand, that's great. You have a full-time position and the school gets, some other voices in there. But then, you know, 2 years is like not really long enough to actually affect the structure of the institution at all. Mm-hmm. But in the 2 years that I was there, there were 2 permanent full-time women faculty, and they both retired. So by the time I left, there were 0 women in the this is in the painting department. There were 0 full-time women teaching in painting. And then they gave my position to a man. So then there were like 0 full-time, permanent or temporary women in the painting department. And this is at a school that has 80% women students.
Right. So beyond the percentages, what other kinds of things did you experience, or if maybe you want to cite an anonymous university or institution elsewhere, but you know, feel free to take it whatever way. But obviously those numbers are numbers that we've heard, here and there. And that's pretty surprising considering the student breakdown, but what about more in depth or personal or, you know, what have you, anecdotal experiences?
I can say also at Mass Art as an example, just of what that, you know, because on the one hand, yeah, you're totally right, like that, you know, to cite a number like that doesn't really give maybe someone who doesn't have an idea of what that would feel like to be in that situation any kind of insight into that. But, something that immediately comes to mind at Mass Art, I had a student that I was working with who was a senior, and she had been dealing with an ongoing case of sexual assault from another student the entire time she had been at Mass Art. Mm. And she told me about it. And, you know, she didn't say to me, I'm telling you about this, and I haven't told any other faculty I've had here because you're a woman. But I think that's, you know, likely one of the reasons. It's a lot harder to approach a man in his mid-60s, for example, and talk about how you're being stalked by a fellow student. I think it's a little easier to, you know, to talk to a woman in her 30s about that.
Right.
So that's like one, you know, very like tangible
And how did
instance, I can give of what that's like for, you know, a student.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so, how did your role then continue from there? Was your next step, do I need to, you know, report this, or was it more that you were going to counsel this student?
I mean, legally, you have to report that. I will say that what I ended up doing in that particular instance was saying to the student, you know, because I was brand new there. This was my first semester that this happened. I'm not sure who the person is that we could talk about this to, but how would you feel about me going to talk to them and getting a kind of hypothetical for you, like, this is what your options are. So I did that, and she felt comfortable enough with what her options were that I was able to put her in touch with that person directly.
Mm-hmm. And do you know if things changed for her?
Yeah, I think they did. I mean, I don't want to give too many specifics because I don't want to say anything that would,
right,
you know, in sure. the off chance, like, math art students are listening to
right.
the podcast to, like, identify her. But yeah, I mean, I think the situation got better for her.
Okay, good. Well, anything else in terms of harassment or, you know, sexual politics at other institutions that come to mind for you?
I mean, it's really, most of what happens is so kind of banal and mundane.
Right.
It's hard to even... sometimes you're not even kind of aware of it at the moment.
Right.
I can think of, for example, and most of it's, just how the kind of critical discourse reproduces itself.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that could be like, sexist in a way that's like incredibly subtle.
Mm-hmm.
But, like one other example that just sort of popped into my mind. At a school that I taught at, I was actually not a part of this crit. I heard about it secondhand, but there was a student who had made paintings of that were crotch shots or something, and a student and a woman brought up, these look like they're probably from porn. I think we should probably be talking about porn. Like, it seems like that should be part of the conversation. And a male faculty member said to her, "I think you need to realize when something is your personal issue and not, an issue, you're bringing this up because you're a woman. And therefore somehow uniquely think that talking about something looks like it's from a porn is relevant to bring out into a conversation. Anyway, she was made to feel, as if this faculty was pointing to this being her kind of pet issue,
right?
And not, and immediately made it, made this conversation move elsewhere.
Right.
So a lot of it's just incredibly mundane in terms of how critiques play out and how the kind of discourse moves.
But it sounds like that's an example of, a male faculty being regressive and insensitive in a way that the standards should be set high enough that you don't have those kinds of comments.
Sure. I mean, I can think of in my own experience, and I feel comfortable naming names here because it was an experience I had as a student. I can remember when I was at Yale, Mel Bachner taught critical issues or whatever, this class that every, first year student had to take. And he, I believe he began that class with showing Picasso. No, maybe it was Van Gogh. I think it was Van Gogh. And he ended, and every week he talked about the work of a different male artist, and he ended with himself, and said, in his typical kind of male arrogant fashion, "I really don't think any, meaningful contributions have been made to art history since, since me."
since me.
The work that I did in the 70s.
Wow.
And one of the students in the class was like, "Well, that sucks for women, huh?" And he was sort of like, "Oh, whatever." And then she was like, "Well, don't you think there have been any important women artists? And he was like, well, name one. And then that began this like extremely, you know, embarrassing situation where students in the class were like, well, what about, you know, Cindy Sherman, or, you know, like just trying to name like whoever was like the most kind of canonized female artist that they could come up with. And then Mel just being like, you know, and just sort of, you know, I don't think her work is very important for such and such a reason. And
was he chair at one time?
No.
But
he was full time there for a while, but but no, he was never.
Until when did he leave, do you know?
It was after my time, you know, fairly recently, maybe 5 years ago or so.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a little, in, you know, 5-6 years or so.
Did he have a reputation of being kind of a dick?
Yes.
Okay. Well, there's proof of it, ladies and gentlemen. Jesus. Because I remember hearing his name mentioned in another Yale alumni's conversation, but I think it was just in passing. So anyway.
I mean, he actually, you know, speaking of teaching, though, he did something. He gave me a negative example that I think about actually all the time when I'm teaching, which is not, you know, I mean, what I just said is obviously a negative example, but I, you know, if I hadn't had Mel as a teacher, I don't think I would be at any risk of, you know, doing a class in which I lecture on a like highly canonized male artist every week.
Right.
But, he, you know, Mel's work is, you know, is and has been very engaged with issues of language, and specifically like how language appears as image via painting, and that's something that I have thought about a lot too. And Mel, you know, he is a super knowledgeable guy. I mean, he's smart in, you know, in certain ways. In other ways, you know, as the example I just gave, I think demonstrates, he can be an idiot. But anyway, I perceived him as a student to be someone who had access to things that I was curious about. And so I was always eager to have these conversations with him that never played out because he was so, you know, sort of like dismissive or disinterested in my work.
Mm.
And then my last semester there, I did a painting that for whatever reason, Mal was like, this is a great painting, you know? And I remember thinking like, oh, good. You know, not in this sort of sense of like, now I have his approval and that's like gratifying, but more like, okay, now that I what feels like for arbitrary reasons, I have his approval, now I'll be able to talk to him about all these other things.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I was like, oh, okay, great. Well, you know, I was thinking about this and I was trying to figure out this and had questions about this, etc. And just sort of listened to me and then said, none of that matters. This is just a really great painting. And it taught me, how kind of arbitrary it is, you know, as a sort of pedagogical lesson, how like kind of arbitrary that, like the approval or disapproval of your teacher is, you know, it's much more useful for them to, you know, to tell you things. Right. So I, something that I kind of set up as a rule for myself in teaching is to like, not give that, you know, that like qualitative, kind of criticism. Like I try to never say like, this is good or this is bad.
Right.
Cause I don't, you know, if a student is very insecure, then they want the approval. If they're like, you know, maybe I'm more like how I was as a student. And if they're like, you know, a little more like cantankerous, they like, maybe will like thrive off of like disapproval, but either way, it's like ultimately not useful.
It seems two things come to mind. One is that he represents, and in fact was, it sounds like was probably in one of the later classes of the sort of former blowhard school, you know, which still does exist obviously in too many art institutions, but certainly a very, you know, solid member of the blowhard school of teaching. And also, and on the flip side, you know, the way that you've implied you're moving forward, and I think the way younger generations of teachers and artists have been moving forward is, you know, so much more sophisticated and thoughtful than that kind of platitudinous sort of, you know, what's the sort of image that I want to create? You know, kind of shit-kicking, swaggering, you know, professor coming into the studio kind of thing.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's a danger just hearing you lay that out. It also occurs to me that it's maybe worth saying that there's, you know, there's a danger in the reverse too, you know, the, like the, you know, the situation in which like whatever the sort of like cliche of like postmodernism in which like everything is possible and therefore like nothing is, you know, there are no stakes. And so I think the challenge as a teacher is to like try and figure out a way that you can make the stakes of the work really clear, or make to the student really clear like what kind of position they're taking in their work and, and where that might, how that might play out without saying like this is good or this is bad.
Yeah. Well, another way of putting it too, which is something that has come up in conversations on this show a couple of times, is the studio visit approach. You know, what is the studio visit? What is the ideal studio visit approach? And that is that you tailor your studio visit to the needs of the recipient, of to the artist. You know, if they are a vulnerable, indecisive, insecure or artist, or at a very insecure place, you know, you have to wade more into that non-qualitative, maybe even slightly vague sort of big picture kind of approach. Whereas if they're, you know, maybe much more open and at an obvious turning point to them, you know, you see where I'm going with this, you know, that you can apply more offense, as it were. But he seems, just to take this one, you know, extreme example, he seems to have none of those faculties at his fingertips. And I guess to finish that point, I would challenge, you know, and you can help me with this with your experience, both as a faculty member and a student, whether a lot of that guard or that era of teachers, you know, if that's a consistent theme.
The kind of move from the sort of like theatrics of the blowhard to something.
Yeah. In other words, this is the sort of closing, the ending of the blowhard generation is basically how we could put it.
But part of me wants to say yes, but part of me feels like that, you know, that's like the dinosaur that just won't go extinct.
Right.
Like, I teach now and I still encounter that guy, you know?
Yeah.
So.
But it's less dominant, I guess, if nothing else.
Yes. I mean, that's definitely true. But still like weirdly alive and well.
And so so let's see if you can think of a situation among your various gigs in which you had either the wherewithal or the opportunity to address it in one way as somebody observing this undying, unkillable residue of the past.
Oh gosh, that's hard. I mean, I try and do it all the time in really small ways, you know, like the story I told earlier about this woman being like shut down in a crit, you know, that was a story, you know,
sure.
Secondhand. I know if I had been there, I would have said, actually, I think what she's bringing up is like relevant. Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
I mean, something that I very much inherited from, you know, some of the political work that I've done is there's a phrase, step up, step back. I don't know if you've ever heard that.
That doesn't ring a bell. It's not one of the more famous utterances of the Occupy era, right?
Well, yeah, and it's definitely not specific to Occupy, but it's something that's just like a lot of political meetings will begin with someone saying like, and everybody remember, like, step up, step back. And it's so ubiquitous in that context that like, usually people are like rolling their eyes and, mm-hmm. you know, in spaces that are sort of like aiming at a more like horizontal, you know, kind of way of organizing.
Right.
And yet in academia, in which like that, you know, that sort of idea is like desperately needed, it, you know, no one's ever heard of it. So at a certain point, I realized that I needed to like, you know, to cross the discourses and like bring that into the space of the classroom. So when I teach, I often, you know, will say like the first class, like, okay, you know, step up, step back is a really easy way of remembering that, like everybody needs to be paying attention to who's speaking in the room and people who, you know, if you're, if you realize that you're speaking more than everyone else, like you may think that you're doing that because there's like a vacuum there that needs to be filled. But maybe if you like let there be some uncomfortable silences, that'll give a space for people who take a little longer to formulate their thoughts to speak. And like alternately, if you're speaking less and you're, you know, the whole time like really frustrated, just like one guy is just going on and on and on, like maybe you can take it upon yourself to like interrupt him or mm-hmm. or throw out a thought before it's like formed. Anyway, like, I mean, that's like maybe not as like a specific kind of instance, but that's just like an example of something that I will try and do as a teacher to like from the get-go say like, this is something that we're working towards. And this is like an easy way of kind of thinking about working towards it.
Mm-hmm. You made me think about something that I never, or I should say rarely, get to employ in this forum, which is to actually push and emphasize the long silences. You know, because when you're having a conversation, much more so in most cases, it's hard to get in. You know, there's the hard to get a word in edgewise, or waiting for the person's lips to stop moving so you can start talking. You know, there's that.
Yeah.
There's that extreme. But even on the sort of milder end, you know, there's so rarely the opportunity to, or the implicit permission to not feel forced by either party to fill in that space. And I'm not necessarily going to, you know, force that issue or be in a contrived way start doing that now. But it does make me think about your experience being in seminars and wondering about what kinds of things you have ascertained or collected over time when you do have those silences. Because, you know, I've only been really, I mean, I've been in some situations outside of post-school, but mainly my experience with seminars is being a student myself. And, you know, that's pretty limited. So I'd be curious to know, when you're in a seminar, particularly a really tense one, you know, and there is that silent period between when, you know, either the artist has spoken or one of the students has spoken about their fellow student's work or whatever. And how would you describe those moments? I mean, what are you, first of all, I guess, what are you doing? Are you trying to figure out what you're going to say next? Or maybe better yet, are you trying to pick up on the room?
Yeah, wow, that's so interesting. I mean, you know, for me, the like anxiety that surrounds those silences really dramatically increased when I began teaching, because
right.
I think as a student, you're usually more like, okay, this is weird, no one's talking, or maybe you have something you're thinking about saying, but you're unsure if you should say it, and you're sort of weighing that. But as a teacher, you feel like, you know, you're in charge of moderating this conversation. So if it's going poorly, I mean, the same thing goes, I mean, I did a lot of art writing, and some of that was doing interviews. So, I mean, I know that anxiety in spaces other than just as a teacher. But yeah, I mean, I think something that can be good to do as a teacher is just to kind of like announce to everybody, like at any given time, what's happening,
right,
you know?
Right.
Like, okay, maybe this is something we're all thinking about. We need to think about it. Let's give ourselves a few minutes to think about it, you know? Or, okay, now we're like taking this time to like make this decision, and just having someone kind of like announce, like, this is what's happening now, kind of takes away that anxiety for
right.
other people.
That sounds really healthy.
Or like something I realized is like, you know, I do a lot of one-on-one studio visits, and I, you know, I think I and most people who do that feel like a tremendous pressure to immediately begin speaking. So you, like, you're maybe seeing work for the first time, and you just have to like immediately begin speaking, like, okay, you know, and then there are these like strategies for like stalling, you know, like, oh, mm-hmm. so, you know, you ask some questions or whatever. But something, and I, you know, I don't even always remember to do it, but something that can be really good to do, I found to be really good to do, is to actually say, I'm going to take a couple minutes just to look.
Right.
So they're not waiting there, like, why isn't she speaking, you know?
Yeah.
But then you've given yourself that permission to just, like, look for a minute.
That is a much preferred, as a artist who has had studio visits, and I'm sure you're going to feel similarly, but correct me if I'm wrong. That is a much preferable thing to hear than just a slew of compliments, which feel good in the moment probably, but when you look back on that studio visit later, you think to yourself, that person was just sort of filling up the air to avoid, you know, the awkwardness of not saying anything.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, from the other end of being, you know, a receiver of a visit, I mean, the visits that afterwards I feel really, you know, usually best about are the ones in which I actually saw someone looking at what I was doing.
Right.
I mean, I think I'm a, you know, someone who works primarily as a painter, and my paintings tend to be pretty labor intensive. And so I'm always, you know, I'm putting all this sort of eyeball time into them. And it's, yeah, to have someone like come in and like immediately just like sit down and start, you know, delivering whatever kind of commentary feels really weird.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I can think of a friend who I had over the studio recently who's, someone I've known for a long time, but for whatever reason, just recently we did, like, an official studio visit.
Mm-hmm.
And she, she spent a really long time looking at things. And we did, you know, the conversation wasn't even that lengthy, but it, you know, I like left it being like, oh wow, she really saw what I'm doing.
Did you feel like that she adequately communicated through what she, the limited things that she did say, that she had seen them as in that intensely?
Yeah. I mean, yes, absolutely. You know, it wasn't,
right.
You know, as if the visit passed in silence.
right.
But it was really, you know, I could see her, you know, and it's also, you know, as a maker, I think we all know what it feels like to have like another maker come to the studio, mm-hmm. and then they're like, oh, how'd this thing get made? And mm-hmm. they're kind of curious about it in a really different way than someone who doesn't
right.
make things or make things in a similar kind of way.
Do you have any particularly epic studio visits, or if not studio visits, seminars that come to mind to the top of your memory?
Oh, epic in what sense?
Well, it could be in the intensely awkward or painful or disastrous sense, or I suppose it could be in the good sense, although, you know, those are very few and far between. Certainly, when they're described, you know, it's not very interesting to listen to.
I mean, I can think of, like, this maybe was the first semester I was teaching, so I was really young and, you know, really anxious to kind of do a good job. I had a student who, like, pretty much every time I came into her studio, she would cry. And I would try, being like, are you okay? Is there anything you want to talk about? I would try ignoring the fact that she was crying. I would try getting her Kleenex. I would try, you know, I tried like what to me seemed like every possible way of dealing with it to see if, you know, if it would make it better, but it was just like every studio visit that happened.
Right. And why?
I mean, obviously she was just having, you know, some kind of, I'm sure, you know, something was going on in her life, but, I think maybe now I would be like better equipped to see, but then I was like 24 and teaching for the first time. And I was like, oh my God, I'm making you cry. Like, what am I doing?
Right. You thought you had all this power.
I remember telling a good friend of mine who, you know, is a guy who's about like 6'8" and has like a, you know, like a foot and a half long beard and looks, you know, he's like a very intense looking guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, Colleen, he's like, he, you know, who teaches. And he was like, I have that before, but how do you think I feel when that happens?
Right.
Funny, because this friend of mine is someone that like you would not want to, you know, if you didn't know him, be patting your back while you were, you know, crying.
Right. Well, we haven't, and it's okay with me, and it sounds like it's okay with you, but we haven't talked about your work. And as you know, as I think we talked about in our earlier phone conversation, you know, talking about visual work in a audio context is a, you know, uphill battle. But I did, if nothing else, want to ask you what the deal was with you and Google, since Google seems to be a big theme for you.
Yeah, I mean, those paintings are a little older now, but I can certainly, I mean, for how I kind of, I got involved in making those paintings in a little bit of a backdoor way. My my way back when, kind of background was in dance. And so when I started making paintings or, you know, making visual work, it made a lot of sense for me to use myself and use my body because I was, you know, accustomed to that as a performer. And I was really kind of thrown for a loop by the difference in the way that people responded to, you know, say a self-portrait that was a painting versus, you know, a dance that, you know, obviously the dancer's body would be the sort of medium there. And there was this like assumed autobiographical or self-expressive read, which I think also is somewhat gendered. I think that happens more to women artists, but I think mm-hmm. I know it happens to everybody. And so anyway, I was really, you know, kind of thrown for a loop there. And so for many, you know, and this is something that's like become clear to me in retrospect, maybe it wasn't totally clear to me at the time, but for many years, I was like making work from like this almost like purely kind of negative impulse of wanting to make a self-portrait that couldn't possibly be read as autobiographical or self-expressive, like a kind of negative, you know, self-portrait.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first Google painting I made, it was just the, you know, it was like a 7x10 foot painting of, you know, the image that you see on your screen when you're going to, you know, do a search, and it had my name in the search bar. And so I was, you know, pre-results, I was thinking about that as, you know, a kind of like presentation of the self in which there was like zero information, right? You knew nothing.
Right.
It was a presentation of the self that was like completely blank. So that's how I, you know, I kind of got involved in it, like not at all in an interest with like, you know, Google as a corporation or
right.
like thinking about like what it meant to be like making a, you know, a virtual image and a painting or all these other things that like immediately kind of came up. But instead it was through this sort of interest in kind of, you know, like at the exact same time as I made that painting, I made a painting of a mirror without a reflection in it. And I like in my head, they're very much kind of this, you know, different ways of like getting at the same idea.
Right. What kind of dance did you do?
Ballet.
When you were talking about that and, you know, in relation to the painting, I was wondering whether what seems to me anyway, burst of dance in contemporary art has given you certain feelings of, you know, either envy or you know, any other kinds of feelings. And if, in fact, you've noticed that as well.
Yeah, I definitely noticed that as well. I think that's really, you know, pretty objectively, it's verifiable at this
right.
point that there's been this, like, real almost obsession with dance in an art context. I have, you know, I mean, for me, I was, you know, I was doing, like, classical ballet, and I really wasn't introduced to modern dance at all. And if I had been, maybe that would have, I mean, I think I ultimately wouldn't have stayed in that field, but it definitely would have interested me in ways that ballet was ceasing to when I stopped.
Mm-hmm.
But, I found that, like, more recently, I don't think I've done anything that's, like, explicitly brings in dance as content, but it's like much more present in my work in the ways that I'm working with the body in a much more abstract way in the paintings I'm making now, I guess I'll say. And so dance is something that comes up, and there are certain things that I've looked at, like, I, you know, more recently than I'd like to admit, you know, kind of uncovered the, you know, and it's not like there's some serious detective work here, but it just wasn't presented to me in terms of how I was introduced to minimalism. But I've recently looked into more of the kind of link between Simone Forte and Yvonne Rainer and, you know, Robert Morris and other kind of minimalist artists, and how collaborative those, you know, so many of the canonical minimalist works that we think of as, like, discrete objects were actually made in a much more collaborative environment, basically, is what I'm trying to say, and it involves mm-hmm. dancers.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that's kind of, you know, been feeding my work a little bit. So if there is a zeitgeist there, I feel like I'm, you know, maybe, you know, less explicitly, but nevertheless, a little bit tapped into that. I don't know if I have anything particularly profound to say about, you know, I think, like, why certain things, certain, like, trends kind of emerge in art or other fields, like, maybe not, it seems always a little bit, like, arbitrary and capricious. Me.
Yeah, no, I'm not I wasn't actually looking for a rationale as to why there's this burst in dance in contemporary art, more just that, you know, you being a painter now and a former dancer,
right.
seeing all this dance going, oh, what, you know, what the fuck? Where was this burst when I was a dancer myself, you know, or whatever?
Yeah. I mean, do you have any thoughts on why?
I haven't seen much of it. There was something in the last Made in L.A. at the Hammer Museum, which I didn't interest me at all. And I know there was something in the Whitney Biennial in, was it 2012, maybe? That involved performance, which I didn't see myself. So other than that, nothing particularly comes to mind. But, it seems trendy. And it's not something I think about. But I did think about it when you mentioned that you were a dancer.
I mean, to me, I'll speak maybe a little, you know, to what's fascinating to me about it, which I'll maybe just, like, extrapolate from that and sort of say maybe that's fascinating to some other people too.
Right.
Is it's like a history of modernism in which the body is integral, right? So, like, the history of modernism, you know, we've been given, or certainly, like, as a painter I was first exposed to, was one in which, like, the body was rejected. And and then, you know, there's this whole other history that's, like, very much engaged with abstraction and very much engaged with, you know, all the sort of issues of modernist painting. And yet it's one in which, like, the body is the medium. I think that's fascination is not just my own. I think maybe that has something to do with,
right.
with why some people are looking at it right now.
Right. I think you've got it.
Did I give the right answer? Did I win a prize?
Well, Colleen, thank you very much for talking to me.
Oh, thank you. It was a total pleasure.
Absolutely. And
okay.
We're out. Thank you again to Colleen for talking to us about all of those sort of art tangentially related things. I think all that stuff is actually more relevant than maybe it seems, because it connects to gentrification and the ever-expanding community where artists can actually habitate. I want to remind you that this is a listener-supported show. Your contributions financially and otherwise are very much appreciated. I wanted to give a special shout-out and thank you to Eric Cellarier, who is an artist and teacher, and not only gave a very generous donation, but also gave me some great feedback about how helpful the show has been to him. I love getting those kinds of comments. Of course, the donations along with them are even better. So love seeing those emails in the inbox saying you have a donation, and then subsequently having a conversation via email with the donator. If you would like to join that multitude or that small group, I would appreciate it. Otherwise, you can certainly support the show by spreading the word, telling your friends, leaving a nice review on iTunes, which is linked through the site, and becoming a fan on the social media, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And by the way, just to remind you, if you do become a fan on Facebook, that means you have to go to the Facebook page and like the conversation, as pedantic as that is. But it gives me a bigger count. We're heading towards 1,000. It's taken us a while to get there. If you want to help add to that list, it's greatly appreciated. All right. I think that's about it. Thank you so much. Oh, and by the way, in regards to the, contributions, we are at once a week now, and it is, I'm telling you, it's a lot of work and it's very intense and it's a little stressful because I'm going through the process of booking people for future shows. And, you know, I've had a couple of phone calls to potentially book people in the same day, and it's pretty intense. So I guess I'm kind of complaining, but I'm just trying to give you a sense of what goes into the show. So your contributions and support in any way that you can is very much appreciated. All right, I'll leave it at that. And I will talk to you next week. Thank you again for listening to the show. Ciao for now.